I want you to do something for me right now. Just take a second and notice how you are breathing in this exact moment as you listen to this.
Yeah, people almost never notice it unless you point it out.
Right. Don't change it. Just observe it. Like, are your shoulders slumped forward a little bit? Is your breath kind of shallow, maybe tracked right up in the top of your chest?
Most likely, yes. I mean, we just walk around holding our breath, keeping everything tight, you know?
Yeah.
We treat our most basic survival mechanism as an afterthought.
Exactly. And that simple, shallow breath is basically the perfect gateway into what we are exploring today. We've gathered this really fascinating stack of sources for this deep dive.
We have, yeah. Clinical psychology journals, some wild historical accounts from the 1960s human potential movement, and modern somatic therapy training manuals.
And the foundational premise across all of these texts, which I love, by the way, is that the body is a living physical archive.
Yes.
Every single experience you go through, especially moments of threat or loss or trauma, is lived together with your breath.
Because, I mean, our breath is our most basic cycle of nourishment. It comes before water, before food, before sleep.
Right.
So when we encounter something overwhelming, our natural instinctual tendency is usually to drink that breath or to, you know, stop it altogether. We freeze.
The biological imperative is just to make ourselves small, like unnoticeable to whatever the threat is.
Exactly. But the thing is, when we freeze or when we swallow our feelings because we're kids, and there's no safe place to express them.
Or even as adults, right? Like in a highly stressful meeting.
Oh, absolutely. That physical contraction doesn't just vanish into thin air when the meeting is over. It is literally filed away.
It gets written into your muscles, your tissues.
Yeah, your diaphragm. And even, surprisingly, the hidden muscles of the pelvis. Over a lifetime, a person ends up building this vast, silent archive of emotional documents that were just, well, never completed.
It's a physiological record of danger that stopped mid-play because the energy generated by the fight-or-flight response had nowhere to go, so the body just built a wall around it to deal with it later.
Exactly. And that brings us to our mission today. We are going to explore the story and the exact mechanics behind a really precise somatic tool called rebirthing, or circular breathing.
And just to be clear, this isn't just about taking a deep breath to relax and lower your heart rate for a few minutes?
No, not at all. It is a method designed to pry open those locked drawers of your physical archive and allow those unfinished emotional experiences to finally reach their natural end.
But to really grasp why we need a physical tool to do this, I think we first have to look at the gap between the mind and the body, right? Like, why isn't simply talking about our problems in traditional psychotherapy always enough to resolve them?
Right. Okay, let's unpack this, because I think so many of us have been in that place where we know exactly why we hurt.
Oh, for sure. You can sit on a therapist's couch and explain perfectly why you struggle with intimacy or, you know, why you get incredibly anxious at 3 p.m. every single Sunday.
You have the cognitive explanation completely locked down.
Yeah. And the sources have this brilliant analogy for this. They say that cognitive understanding is like an expert archivist who works down in a basement.
I love this analogy.
It's so good. So this archivist can look at a box and tell you exactly when it was packed, who sent it, and categorize it flawlessly under, you know, childhood trauma, subcategory B.
But the box itself, it stays completely sealed shut with thick tape. The archivist never actually opens it.
Right. So wait, simply knowing why I'm anxious does absolutely nothing to tell my nervous system that I'm actually safe.
Nope. The physical record of that danger is still etched into the tissues of your chest and belly. The nervous system doesn't speak English.
Wow.
It really isn't listening to the archivist's logical labels. It keeps reacting as if the threat is happening right now in this very moment.
So that is why a purely intellectual approach eventually hits a wall. You can analyze the box for decades, talk about the color of the tape and the handwriting on the label.
But until you break the tape, the contents are still trapped inside. The cognitive understanding is brilliant at analyzing, but the thinking mind cannot convince the body's tissues that a past threat is over just by using rational arguments.
Okay, so if the intellectual mind, our brilliant archivist, can't pry the box open, how do we access it?
Well, the answer to that actually comes from a surprisingly accidental discovery in a San Francisco bathtub in the 1960s.
A bathtub? Amazing.
Yeah. So the lineage of this specific practice begins in 1962 with a man named Leonard Orr. He wasn't a doctor or traditional psychotherapist. He was just this inquisitive researcher of human consciousness.
Right.
And he discovered the profound effect of continuous breathing while just soaking in his hot bathtub at home. As he stayed in the water for incredibly long stretches, his breathing naturally started shifting. It became circular, fast, and connected.
And as he let that happen, he started experiencing these intense emotional and physical regressions. Like, he felt like he was reliving his own birth.
Yeah, which is where the rather intense name rebirthing eventually came from. He realized that the combination of the hot water and this connected breath was acting like a gentle solvent.
A solvent for the archive.
Exactly. It was dissolving the deepest physical holding patterns that had been recorded in his body since his earliest moments. And he spent the next 13 years refining this observation into a workable methodology.
You really have to picture the cultural backdrop here, too. This is San Francisco, late 60s, early 70s. The human potential movement is exploding around places like Theta House.
Right. People were realizing that the rigid social structures of the 1950s had left them incredibly developed intellectually, but totally disconnected and contracted physically.
And this exploration was happening alongside other groundbreaking somatic work, right? Like Stanislav Grof.
Yes. Psychiatrist Stanislav Grof was developing holotropic breathwork around the very same time. Grof was a psychoanalyst who had been researching the therapeutic use of LSD.
Right. And when the laws changed and those substances were banned, he had to pivot.
Exactly. He started looking for non-pharmacological ways to access altered states of consciousness. And he discovered that deep, fast breathing to evocative music could achieve similar results.
So Grof and Orr were essentially coming to a very similar conclusion from completely different directions.
Yes. That human suffering isn't just a collection of mistaken thoughts. It's a deep systemic blockage of energy in the body that you have to meet through direct sensory experience.
But Orr didn't build the structure we use today all by himself. A woman named Sandra Ray enters the picture here.
Ah, yes. Sandra Ray, often called the mother of rebirthing.
She was a registered nurse.
She was, yeah. So she brought this incredibly grounded, deep understanding of human anatomy and physiology to the table. She was crucial in formalizing the practice.
Because she linked the physical breathing contractions she saw in clients to the core beliefs we formed during our earliest childhood years.
Right. Beliefs about how safe the world is, whether we're allowed to take up space, or if survival just means constant struggle.
She saw how those psychological patterns mapped directly onto how a person breathed.
Exactly. Like, if someone believed the world was hostile, their inhale was tight and guarded.
Okay, I want to get into how this actually works physically, because the mechanics laid out in the manuals are so specific. First off, you lie flat on your back on a thick mat, but critically, with absolutely no pillow under your head.
Removing the pillow serves two vital purposes. Physically, it keeps the airway completely open and unrestricted from the throat down to the diaphragm.
Okay, makes sense.
And psychologically, lying perfectly flat signals to your nervous system that you are fully supported by the ground. You don't need to hold yourself upright. There is no immediate threat requiring you to stand or flee. It's a physical cue of profound safety.
Okay, so once you're flat, you open your mouth wide but keep the jaw totally relaxed, and you start taking deep, active inhales right into the upper chest.
Right. You're aiming to really fill the lungs.
But the moment that inhale hits its absolute peak, without pausing for even a fraction of a second, you just let the exhale happen on its own.
Yes, it is an entirely passive exhale, just surrendering to gravity.
Yay.
No pushing the air out.
And the instant the air is gone, boom, right into the next active inhale. No pauses at all at the top or the bottom.
What's fascinating here is the vital importance of that passive exhale. That cannot be overstated. Wow. That is the true secret to the mechanics of this practice.
There is this great quote from Leonard Orr where he says, "We can relax out of any kind of intense emotion or physical sensation when we have the simple, powerful skill of conscious breathing."
Relax out of it.
Yes. That word relax feels like everything here, because when people hear about, you know, breaking through trauma, they think they need to fight it.
Right. They tense up.
It's like they're trying to force the archive doors open with a crowbar, breathing aggressively and violently to smash through their blocks.
But Orr's insight was the exact opposite of the crowbar approach. You do not force your way into the archive. The continuous breath gives you the energy and the fuel, sure. But it is your capacity to relax your jaw, to release your chest, and to truly trust gravity on that passive exhale that actually allows the internal drawers to slide open without friction. You are relaxing into the archive, not breaking and entering.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Breathing continuously like this in an unbroken loop for an extended period isn't just a symbolic exercise in relaxation.
Not at all.
It triggers a profound, measurable chemical shift in your body.
Right. To give you a sense of scale, a typical session is about 2 to 3 hours long in total, but the active circular breathing phase lasts between 30 and 45 minutes.
That's a long time to breathe like that.
It is. And during that window, you create a biological phenomenon known as respiratory alkalosis.
I'd love a breakdown of that. This seems to be the exact mechanical process of bypassing that expert archivist we talked about earlier.
Exactly.
By breathing this way, we are expelling a massive amount of carbon dioxide.
Right. When you expel that much carbon dioxide without pausing, your blood actually becomes more alkaline or more basic. This shift in the blood's pH level triggers something called the Bohr effect. It changes the physical shape of a protein called hemoglobin, which is the carrier in your blood that transports oxygen to your cells.
Okay, let me make sure I'm getting this. Because its shape changes, the hemoglobin actually binds the oxygen more tightly.
Correct.
It holds onto it instead of releasing it to the cells as easily. But hold on, if we're changing how hemoglobin releases oxygen, meaning less oxygen is getting dropped off, are we literally suffocating the body of oxygen to feel better? Isn't that dangerous?
It's a very common concern, but no, we aren't talking about dangerous hypoxia here. It is a temporary localized restriction of oxygen release, and it's heavily monitored in a clinical setting.
Okay, good to know.
Your blood is fully saturated with oxygen because you're breathing so heavily. It's just that the alkaline environment makes the hemoglobin a bit stingy about handing it over to the tissues.
Stingy hemoglobin, got it.
Yeah. And because less oxygen is being released to the tissues, you often experience physical side effects like tetany.
I saw that in the texts. Tetany. It sounds terrifying. It's intense muscle cramping, right? The sources describe people's hands curling up almost like claws.
Yes. Your muscles contract involuntarily, usually in the hands, feet, and sometimes around the mouth. You might also feel intense chills or vibrating sensations.
That sounds intense.
It can be surprising if you don't know it's coming, but it's a completely known, safe metabolic response to the respiratory alkalosis. And more importantly, the lack of oxygen release targets a very specific area, the brain.
Wait, so by changing how hemoglobin behaves, we are essentially suffocating the intellectual guard at the door of the archive.
Precisely. The more modern, rational parts of the brain require massive amounts of energy and oxygen to run. When the hemoglobin gets stingy, those executive suites receive less oxygen, and we can measure a significant drop in their activity.
Wow.
We're talking specifically about the default mode network and the medial prefrontal cortex.
Okay, let's give a real-world translation for those brain regions. The default mode network, or DMN, is basically the inner critic, right?
Yeah.
It's the part of your brain that remembers an embarrassing thing you said 5 years ago while you're trying to sleep, or constantly worries about what your boss thinks of you.
Exactly. And the medial prefrontal cortex acts like the timekeeper and the social filter.
So when these specific regions quiet down because of the respiratory alkalosis, the conscious control we normally use to suppress uncomfortable physical sensations just gives out.
We essentially return to a childlike state of being.
That's wild.
Yeah. When a feeling rises in this state, it doesn't get filtered. It doesn't get analyzed by the medial prefrontal cortex asking, is this the right time or place to cry? Well, being dramatic, let me think of a rational reason why I shouldn't feel sad right now.
It simply comes out. The continuous breath acts like a powerful beam of light shaking the dust off those old folders.
Yes, the drawers are creaking open because the guard is asleep.
But once those drawers are open, the environment you're in makes a huge difference in how those memories are actually processed.
Oh, absolutely. The container for this work dictates everything about how safe the nervous system feels opening those files.
Right.
There is a profound difference between exploring this in a private one-on-one session versus doing it in a group setting.
Yeah, let's talk about that. In a private session, the setup sounds incredibly meticulous. The whole space is tuned exactly to your individual nervous system.
It is. You have a trained facilitator there giving you their undivided attention.
Right. So if you hit a wall of primal fear, or if that tetany in your hands becomes genuinely overwhelming, they're right there to help you fine-tune the rhythm.
They help you find relaxation inside that intensity. It's a highly protected space to open the most terrifying or sensitive files you possess.
But a group session operates on a completely different somatic principle.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, when you have several people lying down in the same room, breathing in this circular pattern together, it creates what the manuals call an ocean of rhythm.
That's such a beautiful phrase, ocean of rhythm.
It really is.
Yeah.
The physical sound of all those people breathing deeply together supports your own breath. The sheer volume of the breathing carries you when you just want to quit.
I can imagine.
And more importantly, it strips away the social masks we all wear. In daily life, we spend enormous amounts of energy pretending everything is fine, keeping it all together. But in the breathing room, those masks melt completely.
It makes me think of an analogy. Like the difference between reading a sad book alone in your room where you can totally control your reaction versus being in a packed movie theater where a stranger's gasp suddenly gives you permission to burst into tears.
That is a perfect analogy. In the group archive, that dynamic is amplified tenfold. The group setting reveals that your personal archive isn't some isolated basement cut off from the rest of the world.
Right.
It is just one shelf in a massive shared human library. If someone across the room lets out a wild, stormy cry or bursts into uninhibited laughter to release tension, that sound literally vibrates in your own body.
It instantly melts the rigidity in your own diaphragm. You might find yourself crying along with them, having no idea what their story is or what trauma they are moving through.
Simply because their willingness to feel their pain validated the pain you've been suppressing. It proves that the contents of our files closely resemble the files of the person lying next to us.
Wow.
When one person finds the courage to meet their record and let the emotion play out to the end, they make it easier for everyone else in the room to do the same.
This sounds incredibly powerful, but also, I mean, incredibly vulnerable. Because this tool is so remarkably effective at breaking down psychological defenses, it requires immense clinical respect. You can't just dive into this recklessly in your living room.
No, you really can't.
So who shouldn't do this?
This raises an important question, right? Circular breathing is not right for every person, and it is certainly not right for every stage of a person's therapeutic journey. We have to be honest about the contraindications.
The clinical guidelines are very strict about this. The sources outline that these aren't just rigid gatekeeping rules. They are expressions of genuine care. For instance, an active psychotic episode is an absolute boundary.
Right. If someone's connection to shared reality is currently compromised, flooding their body with that much raw physical energy and shutting down the rational brain can cause a serious psychological breakdown.
That makes total sense.
The same goes for states altered by heavy substance use. Your nervous system needs to be entirely clear and present to integrate these monumental shifts. We also have to look closely at states like deep clinical depression, unstabilized PTSD, or frequent panic attacks.
Because if your nervous system is already living in a constant state of collapse or extreme hyperarousal, ripping those file drawers open doesn't help at all.
No, it just floods the few defenses you have left, and you end up reliving the trauma rather than releasing it.
In those situations, the clinical priority is building a stable foundation first, right? Establishing safety in the body through gentler modalities before opening the most turbulent drawers.
Exactly. This specific work is meant for someone whose nervous system is generally stable, who has maybe spent years developing that deep intellectual understanding of their patterns, and who is finally just tired of talking about their anxiety.
Yeah.
They are ready to move the work from the head down to the flesh.
So what does this all mean? It's comforting to know there are professional bodies like the International Breathwork Foundation and the Global Professional Breathwork Alliance that set strict ethical and training standards for this.
Yes, very comforting.
When you lie on that mat, you're with someone who knows not only how to open the archive, but how to safely catalog, organize, and close the drawers when it's over.
Which brings us to the most beautiful part of the session, the integration phase, the return.
Walk us through what that actually feels like physically.
So when the active breathing phase of 30 or 45 minutes ends, you stop the continuous loop. You allow your breath to slow down and return to its natural rhythm. You lie completely still, eyes closed. Your body might be gently trembling from the energy moving through it. The archive is quiet now. You see, the active breathing phase was fundamentally a sympathetic nervous system state. It required effort, drive, and fight or flight intensity.
Right, pushing through it.
But the moment you stop forcing the breath, you shift directly into the parasympathetic system, the rest and digest state.
The dust settles.
The dust settles. The drawers are still open, but the feelings that were kept there for decades, the anger, the grief, the terror that were cut off mid-sentence, have finally gotten the chance to finish what they were saying.
Oh, wow.
It opens this direct, relaxed flow between your feelings and your awareness. And when you finally open your eyes and take a normal breath, the sources describe it as feeling like you've just given the house a thorough, deep cleaning.
The air moves easier through your throat. There's this immense feeling of spaciousness, like you finally come home to your own body after being locked out.
It is a profound somatic reset. The nervous system finally gets the message that the past is the past.
We've gone on quite a journey today, starting from the understanding that our bodies are silent storehouses of suppressed emotion.
We really have.
We've looked at the intense physiological mechanics of how circular breathing actually alters our blood chemistry, shapes our hemoglobin, and quiets the rational mind.
Right.
And how, whether in the safety of a private session or the shared resonance of a group, the ultimate goal is allowing trapped feelings to reach their natural end.
Moving from merely understanding our pain intellectually to actually feeling it physically so that we can finally let it go.
I want to leave you with a thought to mull over today, looking at the bigger picture of how we live now. We spend our days hunched over keyboards, staring at screens, barely breathing as we consume endless streams of stressful information.
Yeah, constantly contracting.
Right. So if unexpressed emotions and stress responses are literally paused mid-play inside our tissues, waiting for permission to finish, what unplayed song might your own posture or that shallow breath you take when you're stressed be guarding right now? Are we inadvertently building a global locked archive of physical tension that we don't even have the bodily awareness to feel anymore?
It's a question worth sitting with for sure.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take a deep, relaxed breath, and we'll catch you next time.